I was reading Simon Sharma's book yesterday, Landscape and Memory, and something popped out as I was reading it. He says that landscapes are culture before they are nature, constructs of the imagination projected onto wood and water and rock. But it also should be acknowledged, he goes on to say, that once a certain idea of landscape, a myth, a vision, establishes itself, it has a peculiar way of muddling categories, of making metaphors more real than their reference, of becoming part of the scenery. Sharma's focus was on how cognitive maps and emotional attachment are important in understanding how places are created, but he places too much emphasis on the role of the human and relegates other agents to bit players and background scenery. Our panel has challenged this notion by demonstrating that while representations play a really important role in these environmental politics, nature is far more than a mere category. These papers all show that why it matters that we are should be attentive to the politics that are produced in relations between a range of different sorts of actors. Each of our speakers have animated and identified exactly who is muddling these categories, and it's not always the human. By looking at the places where politics emerge as contestation, it's the constant remaking of nature that challenges ideas about constructivism in environmental thought. The three papers today have all brought different perspectives from their grounded case studies about contested natures. Each examines the way humans live relationally with other species and other things. Tom's paper about multi-species worlds of penguins shows that politics take shape in the types of relationships that form in conservation events. In focusing on environmental justice, it's not just the penguins that are important here, but also foxes and seals. The relationship of each of these species to their humans throws up new questions about the management of invasive species, especially how the sorts of representations, native, invasive, exotic and wild, are remade in conservation work. Through making the deaths of foxes more visible in this paper, Tom asks important questions about how we might remake the conservation of penguins in order to achieve more ethical and thoughtful outcomes for foxes. Heather's paper about the mangroves in the Georges River looked at the constant change in community needs that brings the mangroves into politics in different ways. Thinking about the longer view shows how the same species can be an encroaching invasive, but in a different time frame with a different set of agendas can be seen as a species in need of protection. The deployment of nativism also means questioning who belongs. Heather and Tom offer us the opportunity to think about the active agency of animals and plants in these political processes. Nature is not a mute force separate from culture, but instead mangroves and fur seals disrupt the binary by pushing back through having an agency and therefore stake in their more than human world. Dennis has discussed this idea of intentionality with his ideas of supernatural in the forest temples and stupa in the Thai conservation work that he's engaged with, and shows how they too operate in the dialectic. Like the penguins and the mangroves, these objects become animated in an ongoing process of exchange between a range of different actors in their local settings. The resistance to the modes of living by conservation biologists that emerged in that linguistic representation of supernatural and magical becomes a place for these cross-cultural dialogues at the same time that they're across different disciplines. Sites of sacred nature, as understood by the conservation biologists, become places of friction about what matters to who. As is often the case in conservation work, that is unable to take on board that local interrelationality of nature and culture that Dennis was talking about, what ends up happening is a failure to produce the kinds of environmental justice often espoused within such discourses. With that, I'd like to invite everyone into discussion with our panellists and open the floor for questions. I don't know whether the panellists want to come up, but it is. Or are you happy to stay with me? Questions?
Well, I have lots of questions, but I wanted to start with a very simple factual question to Heather. Are any of is any of that mangrove wood poisonous?
So just have to yell at the acoustics and dribble.
Is any of that mangrove wood poisonous in itself?
I'm not sure. There's a lot of biological stuff which I don't know about mangroves. Cobra is certainly very extensively eaten, and it's not regarded as being contaminated by being a part of living in the roots. But cobras are the long woodworm that live in the roots of mangroves and are harvested from it. I'm not aware of that being the case. I don't know. Carolyn,
do you know anything about it?
I haven't heard that they are.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard of them. People, there's a fruit from mangroves and there's flowers, but I haven't actually heard of people harvesting those. What people mainly talked about is harvesting the cobra, and that's such an essential part of the protein source of all of the Georges River people and the tidal river people up the coast. That I haven't heard anybody talk about any other part of it, but not about avoiding it either.
Leah? Thanks, Jodie. I really enjoyed all the papers. Thanks very much. I guess one of the things that I was really struck by with all three papers was just how much each of them revealed how the discourse of conservation is depoliticised. So despite the discourse of conservation having very particular roots, very particular history, it's almost sort of given to us as an uncontestable, you know, as something that's given and that we should sort of accept. And yet each of the three papers, I thought, really nicely sort of started to tease out some of the hidden politics of this very discourse of conservation. And I guess it makes me wonder about how we might think more closely about the governance of conservation. So not only decisions around what might be conserved, but how we might actually go about thinking about conservation in a more explicit way to sort of reveal the kinds of histories that are behind the notion of conservation. So. Not really a question for anybody, but it's something that really intrigued me that kind of came out of all three of the papers, this idea of the politics of conservation. And we sort of receive a very deep and politicised idea of conservation so often in cases like these.
To respond on that, on Leanne's point?
And I'd like to ask the National Parks and Wildlife people here the degree to which this any of those ideas that we've floated are circulating inside DSSEW. I mean, to what extent is this debate occurring inside the organisation? Or, I mean, there's enormous pressures because of no funding and not enough people and continual restructuring, but to what extent is this sort of questioning occurring?
One very specific answer to that is some of what Tom talked about earlier I've come across, and you've probably come across the same things, talking about the impact of removing foxes or dingoes from an environment that they then stop eating the smaller marsupials, but there's an impact on the lizards and the smaller animals that then, I can't remember exactly how it works, but there, you know, there is that questioning of is eradication of species that have been there for quite a long time and have become part of the new biodiversity, the new ecosystem. You know, what then is the impact on species that have been there for a longer period? So I've come across that in an internal kind of forum, but that's just one specific answer.
I've come across that too in National Parks and Wildlife, but as a way that what that means there is that we should be careful about how we eradicate.
It's not the same philosophical approach that you bring to that.
The National Parks and Wildlife Service it recruits most of its staff from conservation biology. That has always been the case. We have argued for a long time, tried to get them to recruit more people with a background in cultural heritage. You know, that could be history, anthropology, archaeology. But it's an uphill battle because the field is seen to belong to conservation biology that, you know, is strongly perceived to be the proper knowledge of conservation and national park management. But, you know, one can find it. Could I just go back to the earlier question about depoliticized or apolitical conservation discourse? It seemed to me that in the case that I was talking about, it was, you know, that was a case of conservation biologists, most of them actually in Europe, looking across the world to Thailand and what is happening in Thailand. And I guess, you know, they read the most available literature, which is probably the material, you know, the Thai government has sort of got on Renaissance and so on. It's the version of Buddhism and religion in Thailand that they get is one that is sort of fairly shallow, but also happens to be the one that the historical reasons, the political reasons, de-emphasizes the supernatural. And so what they have fallen into themselves is kind of have joined the ranks of this anti-superstition discourse, but accidentally. You know, it's accidental. It's simply that they don't know enough. There's a kind of innocence about it. When I was drafting my chapter, second first draft, they came back with this thing with, supernatural, could you not use that word? We're kind of uncomfortable with that word. And I thought, well, you know, what would be an alternative? In anthropology, you know, the term magical would be a good alternative. Needless to say, they couldn't deal with magic. So, you know, they were arguing for, you know, could we use the word spiritual? And, you know, and you can kind of imagine why.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I might want to argue with you a little bit over just how accidental it is. I thought that was such a great point that you made. Modernity can't stand that stuff. It can't stand a miracle because nobody knows where they're going to erupt. And, you know, they can't stand that kind of diffuse power that anybody can put their hands on, because you know what people are going to do. And I think that the conservation biology, you know, much as we need them and much as we respect them, are also wanting to imagine a world in which miracles don't erupt and in which power isn't diffused that way. Once really, you know, in spite of sort of knowing that they don't know everything, still want to imagine a way of kind of controlling things. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it makes no sense.
Yeah,
okay. So I think you're. I would certainly agree with you that they weren't sort of wanting to, not doing this for political purposes, but it's kind of meshing of worldviews, isn't it?
Yeah.
So could you change their mind, Dennis? Did they go with supernatural?
Oh yes, yeah.
You know,
the whole
did
point
you,
of this
if it's accidental, did you undo
the whole point
their
of this chapter was to argue specifically against that. That kind of effacement of supernatural.
I'm just wondering whether there isn't a sort of hierarchy of language and the attached, I don't know what you call it, political emotional intensity associated with each of the categories. Because if you like, it seems to me that one of the big issues around this is the relationship, just one of the small issues, the relationship between religion and science. In that, when you're making an argument about, if you like, a biological terrain which has imposed on it traditional, can I use the term mythological characteristics rather than mystical, supernatural, spiritual, mythological characteristics, arguing respect is actually saying something about your relationship with the people, not with the ideas. Because it seems to me that, if you like, a scientific preservation strategy is not actually one that would say there is some scientific truth in the statements that the local people make about the space. What's scientifically true is they hold those beliefs. what you're actually doing is, it's actually a relationship with them rather than the place that, I would argue anyway, the spaces themselves only have meanings that are politically fought over in some way or another. There's nothing imminent in the spaces, even though people looking at those spaces from different perspectives would claim there's some imminent meaning in them. Mm. And I'm just wondering how you deal with those sorts of questions. I mean, you've suggested that spiritual is more acceptable than magical within the framework of bureaucratic authorities. I'm wondering why that might be. Sorry, there are too many bits in that. But, I mean, essentially, what I'm trying to feel out is what sorts of claims to imminent meaning in space, maybe a better way of putting it, are validated by what sorts of legal practices? Because I'm thinking a bit, for instance, of Heather's or your work on the Georges River, and say the claims about the space by Anglo-Australians versus Indigenous versus Vietnamese. Now, in a sense, in the hierarchy of authenticity, our culture, our political culture, that of sort of left, liberal, progressive, whatever, would give greatest value to the Indigenous claims. We would then probably give greater value to the Anglo-Australian claims because they've been there longer than the Vietnamese. And we'd be highly suspicious of any claims by Vietnamese to any imminent spiritual values associated with the place, because it's so recent.
We would.
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
I agree with that, you know, that hierarchy exists, and, you know, we have, in our work on the Georges River, you know, we stumbled upon what appeared to be quite a widespread belief that the river was actually a dragon. The river itself was a dragon.
Oh, a dragon.
And that explained why the Vietnamese wouldn't live along some parts of it, because they were parts of the anatomy of the dragon. Mm. And when we, you know, expressed surprise about this, we were told, oh, everyone in the Vietnamese community knows that. But it had no visibility outside of that community, and I would assume that it wouldn't actually be taken very seriously either. It wouldn't be given the kind of credence that Aboriginal sacred sites, for instance, on the river would be given.
And do you think that's right?
Oh, no.
No. So you give equal value to those?
Oh, well, I think I would, yeah. But I guess in society what happens is that there is this kind of contestation. And, you know, in Thailand and in Asia generally, the state has been trying to suppress popular religion for the best part of 150 years now, and all indications in China, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Thailand are that belief in the supernatural is actually increasing, and it's increasing through a link to the developing economies in those areas. So, I mean, you know, there's been this battle against popular religion, and popular religion is kind of back for various reasons.
I mean, I'd argue that what we're talking about is about state policy, in a sense, and which gets recognised to what extent and to what purpose. And the state policy enacted by DECCW at the moment is prepared to acknowledge Aboriginal interests in that are labelled spiritual to a certain extent, as long as they don't conflict with other sorts of commercial uses. But they're not prepared to acknowledge that there are any others. And they're also not prepared to acknowledge that Anglo-Irish or Irish or Scots beliefs are religious beliefs. They're regarded as orthodoxy or fact or something. So in a sense, the discussion for me on the Georges River stuff is that the the approach of the state actually embodies a certain sort of set of politics of privileging one group as the normative, you know, the group which is assumed to be working in terms of fact. The Indigenous group are expected to be recognised and acknowledged, but not actually, you know, given too much power unless it's, you know, if it's inconvenient. And everybody else is ignored. So the argument we've been making is that, in fact, there's a whole body of beliefs, and we need to look at the Anglo-Irish ones or the Anglo-Scots ones as beliefs, but then look at the ways in which the state might deal with them with appropriate respect, I guess. That then opens up all sorts of other questions about the sort of ethics of valuing different things. But once we start opening up the fact that a concept of native is not self-evident, it's not factual and it's not scientific, so what is it? Then I think we get into a much more sensible discussion about why decisions about management are taken.
It really does, you know, the links back to Tom's discussion of nativism is a fascinating one. And Steve Brown, he sort of knows more about this than I do, but National Park Managers, the NPWS, regard are quite supportive of Aboriginal heritage, which is great, but settler cultural heritage in national parks, like wool sheds and things like that, is seen as a kind of a pest in a way, because it's introduced. And we've actually been sort of, and Steve particularly, have been arguing very strongly that all of that is part of what the national parks are. And in fact, you know, the parks are not just a natural landscape, but a cultural natural landscape. But it's an uphill battle.
Just a question down the back, and then Debbie, did you?
Well, I just wanted to ask this question, but Andrew has answered that question. But I was trying to understand the whole thing in a comparative perspective. When the issue of the whole religion and this conservation comes. In Indian context, that's fascinating what you presented like there, that it is widely described that a traditional Hindu will have six mothers. I mean, those mothers, their own mother, the biological mother, the midwife, the river, then it talks about the country, the earth, and the holy cow. These are the mothers, and it will be protected. And it is widely thought about it in the scientific interpretation talks that since a vast number of the people were illiterate, a lot of religious code was made inbuilt to sit with that, these are made enduring in the society in one's thoughts, beliefs, and actions. And also, this is not only practiced by the Hindus, even by the Muslims and Christians equally, in many parts of the country, some respect is shown to river and others in the forest. Now, over the period of time, there has been a lot of erosion. And if we look at the river crossing valley, that is Yamuna River, I mean, it's full of pollution. And pollution one does by choice, another by compulsion. The choices of the politician and the industrialist group, they will allow to flow all kind of industrial waste, etc. like this. You can put your hand in that water full of germs and etc. like this. And another category of the people, those who do it, you know, out of compulsion. I mean, say a small farmer is compelled to blow that water from his farm coming to the Yamuna River, but gradually it is coming out of those compulsions. Now the question comes to me that I would say hither like this, whether there is a class bias in developing an understanding towards the forest or a politics of understanding towards that forest and those kind of things. The mangrove is one of those areas and other things. Whether there is a typical indigenous way of understanding the relationship between the forest, river, and their own existence. Whether it has been eroded over a period of time with the intervention and negotiation with politics and other things.
Your first point, Jabal, I think it's really interesting. Both of them are interesting, but this is the first point raises the question that Dennis has raised, is where you've got a recognition of
strong beliefs in immanence and spirituality. Why is it that people are either participating in deforestation or actively polluting or enabling polluters, commercial polluters, to pollute rivers or to cut down forests? So it's a really interesting question. There's a lot of, the more you get a celebration at some sort of discursive level of indigenous protective attitudes to the environment, when is that operationalised and how is it operationalised to actually enact any protection? It's a really good question. And who's protecting what? I mean, when, you know? What happens like now as opposed to 1787? Where there are situations where you have significant indigenous control in various states in India, what are the conservation outcomes? What are the conservation outcomes where you have various groups which have got strong conservation ethics or protective ethics and do have political power? What are the, they're important questions, and we need to get beyond celebrating an imagined protective cultural complex and looking at what actually the results are on the ground, both in terms of social outcomes and conservation outcomes, if you like, for non-human species. So I think that's one important thing. In terms of the class bias about mangroves, I think one of the issues is use study, and I'm picking this up from one of the concepts Jody's been playing around with. There is certainly a question of whether things are defined as useful or not in particular circumstances. And I mean, I think Indigenous peoples, for example, would have been much more actively involved in, or in, would have been much more actively recognising of the loss of salt marsh. But that's not because they had any big spiritual values about salt marsh. Maybe they did, but because they were using it, they're actually utilising it. And where social groups or community groups have got an active engagement with a particular type of environment, they're going to be very alert to the changes in it. I mean, the Mandaeans, for example, have got a very strong and powerful set of beliefs about the spiritual force of water and rivers. And there is actually, the little Mandaean community at Liverpool actually has an extraordinary proportion, anecdotally, of people who work in water quality agencies. I mean, it's a bunch of people who are actually interested in what's going on. When you have to dunk yourself in it a number of times each year, you become very alert to the question of water quality. So the body, is the ways in which you might know it, you may be eating it, you may be engaging with it in other ways, you may be holding religious activities and ceremonies and concerned about it for a number of reasons, but the way you know that environment is going to indicate whether or not you're going to take notice of it. And there's unquestionably been a very heavy exhibition of class politics along the Georges River as a working class, heavily industrialised river. And when you start looking at it in terms of social history, sociology and politics, not only in environmental, scientific and biological terms, you start opening up questions, I think. And I think you need to look at it in both. There's been very good political economic analyses of Sydney, like Noel Butland's wonderful work about Sydney's industrial development, but he didn't have the slightest interest in anything biological. He didn't look at plants, he didn't really look at even fish and stuff in the rivers. He was looking at polluted air and sewage disposal. Whereas there are, in other places and in other areas, the beginnings of biological studies of the impact of pollution, but very little understanding of the social causes that might be there. Like if you actually massively shove people into an area and then fail to develop the sewage infrastructure, then obviously you're going to get heavy nutrient pollution of the waterways. It's a class issue about environmental justice. And so putting the both together, I think, is really important. It's not only the class issue, but it is also not only the biological issue.
Yeah, I wanted to shift gears a little bit, if that's okay.
Please
do. I had more of a comment than a question, Tom, but it's a comment that invites a response. So one of the things I quite liked about your paper was the way that your moving across a number of species enables you to more clearly highlight just how jolly arbitrary these categories are. And I guess one question I have for myself and for others here is, if they're that arbitrary, are they really useful anymore? I hold that open as a question, not one I have an answer for. But it did seem to me, in thinking about the arbitrariness and how the arbitrariness gets managed by people who are still going to be making decisions, and still going to be making decisions around certain criteria, and wanting to conceal some of those criteria beneath those big categories, that an awful lot rides on the word test. And I would like to give a little example, because it came up in my mind when you, on one of your first slides was the quote from Kim Lowe about Australians, sort of cherish the native and reject the exotic test. Not the exotic, just the exotic test. And then you find that, in fact, anything can be shifted into the term, into the category of pest. And pest becomes sort of the black hole where anything you don't want can be put. And it doesn't really matter where it comes from. So the research I'm doing now in the Botanic Gardens, looking at the expulsion of the flying foxes, where the native is being kicked out in order to protect, allegedly protect, heritage trees that actually, as it turns out, are all exotics. So the native is the pest, and the exotic is the treasured creature, and nobody's interested in conviviality, which is the real tragedy of it. I shouldn't say nobody.
It
people
ironic.
Making those decisions aren't interested in conviviality.
Ironic as well that botanic gardens are heavily involved in conservation work on a whole other range of things, but they can't see the flying foxes. I won't see the gardens as a way of protecting that native species, which is endangered.
It's an endangered
species.
So, not only
really
that, you sort of think that anybody whose commitment in life was to take care of plants, a lot of which are trees in that botanic garden, would have a regard for the native species that are pollinators. So that, in fact, I think sort of takes it a step further into the area of just how detached from any kind of reality a lot of these categories actually are.
I'd love to chart the history of these categories more fully, and I haven't done. But the movement from protecting, in New South Wales, from protecting game species, introduced game species exclusively, through to more and more native species being included, until eventually we arrive at almost the flip side now, where I don't think anything is protected, any species protected that are introduced. So there's been this almost complete reverse. But I think, and lots of people have written about that, especially about the period of time around Federation, where a lot of that shift started to happen as species that have been sort of odd and weird and things became to become identified with as part of a national project. I'm sure there are really interesting issues, but I really sympathise in a way with sympathising national parks and wildlife who have to make decisions. And I think how it seems to me from the outside is that they've inherited categories and a conservation project that is the product of a previous understanding of ecology. And they work with it because they need a conservation goal. And if we just accept that the ecosystems are chaotic and changing, what's the goal of conservation? Where are we trying to manage things to? Whose priorities take precedence over whose? There are fundamental problems with the goals of conservation that these categories help to cover over. I don't know what the goal of conservation should be. This is kind of I suspect that this functions as a shorthand now for this idea of preserving native species and preserving native species where native species should be and in the proportion that should be there, basically 1787. But that functions as a shorthand for maximum native biodiversity. They, having that as a goal, is the best we can estimate, the best possible way of maximising the native biodiversity reserve. What it fails to, I mean, there are a whole heap of problems with that assumption in itself, but it fails to acknowledge all of the other competing interests, claims on landscapes and on other species. So, like the way agriculture has produced pest species in macropods that have never been like that. But the goal of the National Parks and Wildlife Service of conserving back to a kind of 1787 period is problematic all on itself, but then when you put it in with the drastically changed landscapes of agriculture, the demand and desire of the communities not to have tame-eyed wallabies or brush-tailed foxes running around on their roofs. It's just really unworkable conservation goal, but I don't know what the alternative is.
Well, but that's, that's the kind of contradictoriness of the project that really refuses to acknowledge the centrality of the human, that it's really all about humans. All you have to do is put in dingoes, but, you know, nobody wants them running around the backyard. So, that's not all you have to do, but that would solve a whole lot of the issues.
Quick question from Leon? No?
Okay. Can I just ask Tom and Debbie and others to... It seems to me that I'm really struck listening to your paper, Tom, about the... and thinking through this stuff about mangroves, about the continuity of our focus on species and iconic species and the questions that raises. But a lot of conservation activists are really torn about this question about promoting the conservation of iconic species because they're actually very evocative and people want to identify with koalas and they want to identify with little penguins. They're incredibly sweet. And it's that photograph of the fox with the penguin in its mouth is just heart-wrenching. But obviously focusing on iconic species might be good for bringing in dollars to conservation funds and impelling governments to make decisions, but they're not good at helping you to see ecosystems. And sort of what we're all trying to get our heads around is this concept of ecology, which is that term ecology is just proliferated all over the place, and we've got political ecologies and all sorts of other things. And I was struck by Dan Lunny bending over backwards to try and differentiate the two. And what we're all talking about is the sets of webs of connections, however dynamic they might be. But, I mean, even though there's a much more widespread awareness of ecology, we still tend to be thinking in terms of individual species. Is that the sort of thing you're aware of in thinking about the penguins? Or are you striking that sort of question?
Yes, I suppose. I think that the biodiversity discourse has displaced a lot of the species discourse from the middle of the 80s.
People are using the term biodiversity, but in terms of what it actually means...
Well, yeah, biodiversity for many people means species diversity. And that's problematic, I suppose. But in a way, I think that, which is my argument, I can't remember the fellow's name, part of the work of the biodiversity concept was meant to do was to allow conservationists to continue to use species as iconic poster images, while also getting the whole habitat and the ecosystem with it. Because now you can talk about biodiversity conservation, which includes species diversity, genetic diversity, and ecosystem diversity. So I think that the biodiversity discourse is incredibly problematic. I don't like it at all, I'm trying to use the word. But I think it's moved away from species in some ways and allowed other kinds of things like habitat and to be incorporated back into conservation in a way that they were sort of sidelined after the decline of wilderness talk and the focus on threatened species or endangered species. Habitats and ecosystems have come back in a lot more, I think, since in the last couple of decades. But
I suppose what I'm wondering though is whether that's in practice, in fact, what we're doing is looking at context for species like the biodiversity concept is so hard to grasp and to empathise with. Or maybe even just to talk about, maybe that's the problem, that you end up talking about interactions between species in order to be able to describe it at all. But it seems like it's a really hard sell, I think.
I'm personally of the opinion that meaningless, except for all of the political work that we've done, biodiversity. I think you could twist it to make it do any work you wanted to. I had somebody tell me that the reason conserving the penguins at Manly was so important, you know, this is because they're not a threatened species in any way. They're common thing if you go to an island. But they're a threatened population because they're the last mainland population. And that has biodiversity value, apparently, because we don't have any other ecosystems on the mainland in New South Wales where there are little penguins. We don't have any other... So we should get rid of foxes. We don't have any other ecosystems on the mainland that have got foxes and penguins. So we should presumably keep foxes as well. And we don't have foxes on most of those islands. So, and you can... The work that biodiversity does, especially in legislation, where biodiversity becomes native biodiversity, in a really
That's right. It's actually operating with this unspoken constraint, isn't it? And that's one of the things that this sort of discussion opens up, that unspoken stuff about what biodiversity is actually being understood as.
Well, I'm sorry to say it's 6 o'clock. So we're going to have to wind things up. I'd like you all to join me in thanking the panellists.